Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Well, hello, big Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom O. Cardo on the board. SP Futures down 50 cents. NASDAQ Futures up 11. So, not much going on there. Do we have Mr. Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh, I am doing just fine today. It's Friday. What could be wrong?
Yeah, I'm just looking at this new, as we wonder, what was the song? Was the who the hell was it? As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong. That was
Runaway.
Del Shannon, right?
Runaway.
There's
I'm
a song.
I'm not going to sing it for you.
No, there's a song you could play on the outtake, Ricardo. Yesterday we had what was it? Rita Coolidge, you know, all time high. The market was on, but actually we ducked a little down yesterday, so we're still not quite at an all time high. So we probably got to shelve that song until we get back at an all time high. I'm just reading here about this new potential NBA deal and how they're...
I haven't read it yet, so tell me.
Well, it's potential. Evidently, Disney and Time... Well, let's see, the current... I'll start from the beginning. Maybe that's where I should start. Warner Brothers Discovery has been there for, 10 years or something, and they've had this deal that's about 1.2 a year or something, $1.2 billion. Now, of course, the NBA wants double that for less games because they want to give some games to Amazon, too. You really need to sell the games to like three different people, maybe even the same game. What do you think? To take the thing from Major League Baseball or football.
Well, you got to make sure that people have to subscribe to a million different services just, so that you can get a little bit more revenue.
It is,
in my way of thinking, it is such a short-sighted approach to running it, because I'm sure they get some wonderful revenue hits that they like, and God, the NBA is like $5.5 billion in revenue as it is, so it's not like they're hurting for it, but I'm sure they get, and MLB too, they get some revenue hits, but it's so off-putting for fans, and I think in many cases, I talk to people periodically about this, and they say, I'm not going to subscribe to any of them if that's the way they want to do it. It's why should I bother? Why should I pay for Apple only to have something go over to Amazon TV? I said, forget it. Just go away.
Ricardo, see, as a young man, hopefully you're learning when you do this show. Now, what you just learned is Kevin is a spectacular gentleman, brilliant man. This is why he is in Southwest Michigan doing good stuff for people. He doesn't realize that no matter how much money you have, the next dime you have to fight over like it was your first dime, because that's the way you are. Every nickel is that important to you. Kevin has never understood that. Neither have I. That's why we're not Jerry Jones.
Well, it is the classic one of Edward Deming's deadly diseases, and it's the focus on short-term profits instead of the long-term. And it is a deadly disease for any business. I get that every business, especially if it's a publicly traded business, though, has to report earnings every quarter, and there is some pressure and stock market pressure that goes with that. However, I think how much are we seeing the stock market pressure for short term earnings on NVIDIA, or is that really based more on what they're doing, what they're believed to be doing for the long haul? So I think even the markets will reward a good infrastructure in your business.
Current market rewards something that's going up. They don't care why. They don't care if it's a meme stock.
Well, that could be.
But I'm looking at this, and
the market's not totally predict. I'm not saying the market is consistent. What I'm really saying, however, is that that the market does understand, and anybody who evaluates a business understands building long-term value versus short-term value.
That's right. Well, at some point, kind of getting off track here, but at some point, I think the market does come to value a business. It's real hard when stuff is growing real fast, Kevin, because it's hard to predict the end game. But if all of a sudden you have a company or whatever that's making $5 a year and sending you a check for two, and it's done that for 10 years in a row, the market's pretty good at valuing that. You know, you look at the interest rates and you come to a pretty good value for that because it's somewhat predictable. When it's not, you know, when a guy invents something and you think, God, 5 years from now, these guys could own everything, then that's, you know, it's hard to predict. I mean, it really is. I mean, for anybody, you know, the market collectively. But I look at where, I mean, I keep harping a little bit. I mean, when I say harping, it's the big dog in the room. You look at the money that's been poured into the system, and you look at, you know, people like you and me. Well, PTI hasn't been able to triple its prices. As a matter of fact, we probably keep lowering them, for God's sake, for people. I don't know that you've gotten a triple for the classes you teach. I'm going to say no. Yet places where the money finds its way, that's why it's so uneven, why you have to be careful when you do it, and the government, you know, doesn't care, actually, because the government's a big beneficiary. Here's where it's going. Now, these guys are paying $1.2 billion this year. I'm sure there was escalation clauses in it, so I doubt for, I think it's like a 10-year contract they have right now. This is Time Warner, Warner Brothers Discovery. I don't think they're paying the same amount of, I don't know this, but I'm thinking they aren't paying the same amount of money as they did in year one. There's probably some sort of escalation in there, wouldn't you think? But I think it's a 10-year contract. They're paying 1.2, and the new one is supposed to be 2.4. And the interesting part is it's so high that now the guys, Comcast, is bidding against them. Like I said, it's not as many games because they're pulling out some games for Amazon. So now the number appears to be $2.4 billion a year. So now, even though in the contract, Warner Brothers Discovery has a right to match any new offer and keep the deal, now they're trying to say that it's so much money they might not be able to afford it, so they're going to try and take away their right to match. But if you do something like really stupid that I do, if you put this in the inflation calculator from 2014, I think it's a 10-year deal, Guess what the number should be from what our government tells you what your salary increase should be. What do you suppose the total inflation has been since 2014? Last 10 years with COVID.
I don't know. What are we telling them? What are we saying? What's the government
reporting? $1 in 2014 is worth $1.34 now. Not $2. So obviously the NBA has benefited, sports in general have benefited dramatically from the inflation. They've been able to do essentially three times the inflation rate. And part of that reason is, I think that a lot of their sponsors are in the medical community, which have patents and charge unconscionable amounts of money to people. So,
Pfizer has been a huge sponsor.
Yeah, and the new cancer drugs, is that Pfizer? I'm not sure.
Probably,
there's a bunch.
We'll call it news when it isn't Pfizer.
Well, no, there's out of the 10.
I know. There's Merck and the others.
I mean, if you take the ten drugs that are the highest on TV, there's more. I think maybe a couple of them are Pfizer. I mean, I'm not no fan of Pfizer, but I was surprised. There's kind of a sprinkling of other people in there. A couple of them are from Europe. But, you know, most of them are the skin diseases and the I didn't even out of the 10, Kevin, I didn't know what 8 of the diseases were. I guess that means I'm lucky or something. But there's a lot of them are skin, a lot of them are diabetes, Then the fat drugs are in there now. And then the new cancer drugs. A couple of new cancer drugs where they try and kick your body's immune system up a little bit. But, I mean, those are in the top ten. It's not Viagra and Cialis like it was before, because those guys are generic. And also, the other one's generic. What's the one of the biggest selling drugs of all time? It's the statin. Which one am I talking about?
Oh, Lipitor.
Yeah, Lipitor. I think that's off patent now, too, I think. So, a few of the big ones.
Well, that has been for a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, a few of the big... Well, I'm saying they were a big advertiser in their day. But Viagra and Cialis were huge for both CNBC and the NFL. It was like $50 million a year or something. And as soon as they went off pat, oops, we're gone. We'd be good. There's some of those small...
Yeah, they were gone, but now you got all these generic places that advertise.
But they don't have anywhere near the money at $5 a pill. The other guys did it at $55.
No, but they're still advertising like crazy on sports.
A lot on the radio. You hear them on the radio. But you don't see the huge commercials. I still don't know why I remember this one.
Describing everything related to Viagra is huge.
Well, I remember that. Was it the Viagra commercial?
Hey, you know what happens when you give a lawyer Viagra?
You get a what?
When you give a lawyer
oh,
Viagra.
God. Oh, God.
Gets taller.
I still remember. I don't know why I have this fixation. With you know how much it costs to put these commercials together, but the one Viagra commercial where they're going on a trip, the lady is an incredible looking, you know, 40-year-old lady, and she's got the tube of Viagra, the bottle of Viagra for the guy, right? And of course, from what I understand, there's like two or three different dosages. Of course, it's the biggest dose.
And it's like the horse pill.
Yeah, and the guy's got the satchel, like the Indiana Jones, you know, leather satchel with all his stuff in there, and she had probably 10 pieces of the most expensive luggage I've ever seen. This is interesting. The guy's bringing his satchel with like two pairs of underwear. She's bringing a thing of horse pills of Viagra and her entire outfits for like 6 months. Are they going to the same place? But I mean, I don't even know where you'd find that luggage, let alone, anyway, enough with that. But the point is that the money is finding its way into some places and not others. And it comes with sports. Those guys were able to borrow money less than an inflation rate for a long period of time, which is what Carl always talking about. And the value of these franchises and this deal, I mean, you know, that's a lot of dough. I mean, is it? Now it's tied in with gambling and it's tied in with everything else. But for the Cubs, you know, I still watch them. Well, last night they sucked, but I still watch them because I love baseball. And you know, I mean, the bars have the marquee, which essentially you buy every game. Now you know, some of the games are on ESPN, okay, or on Fox. But anybody who has Marquee on a cable package, you've got the other two as well because they're lower down the chain. So it's not that big of a deal to if you have the Marquee to have
yeah,
to...
Yeah, if there's an ESPN game and they don't show it on Marquee, you're okay.
Because you're okay. And then if you're like a bar or you're somebody who's really into it and want to just see the best games... you know, then you can get the Major League Baseball package, which I think is sold to you as every single game, everywhere at all times, right? I think that's the deal. Now, all of a sudden, wait a minute, here comes Apple. Or is it Amazon? One of the two. That's cool. I mean, so now I've got all these different packages, and I still don't have all the games. And it's like, anyway, how many times can you sell the same thing? It's not like, I get a check in the mail tomorrow for my 1/62nd of a Major League Baseball package that I'm not getting. I mean, we're not getting any kind of return here, are we? But anyways, it was a reason, kind of what got me on this subject a little bit, Kevin. We got all kinds of stuff to talk about. Is I was one of the Core Digest things. There was a question: how good is Mike Trout? And the guy who was actually answered the question had all these stats. And I don't. How many different kinds of WAR are there now? About 12, according to this guy. You know, he. He's the best ball player that's ever played. I mean, he's way in his WAR, because his WAR is kind of weird because it's season, but then it adds up as you age, So if your wins above replacement for 20 years, you're way higher than somebody who only played five, even though you might not have been as.
And that makes a certain amount of sense too. Is because now you're measuring not just your effectiveness when you're playing, but your longevity.
But then you drop into the best 5 year war and the best, and then there's a defensive and it's split up a million times. Anyway, according to this guy, he's arguably the best player up until this stage of his career that has ever played, according to him. But the thing that catches me though, Kevin, is I've never seen the guy play. I mean, I don't watch the Sox at 9:30 at night when they're out in the Angels. They never make the playoffs. It seems the Angels, so you never see him in postseason. It's like Ichiro. I mean, I wish I'd have watched the guy play 10 times. He was that good. I never saw him play. Because, same thing. It's a 9:30 game. I don't have the Major League Baseball package, so I'd have to wait for the Sox to go out there before there was interleague play. And I'm not about to watch the Sox at 9:30 at night and try and stay awake. So, I mean, there's two guys that I never got to see, I guess.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I would say it's rarely saw them play, but I did see them play. So, and I've seen, and Ichiro was, he was really cool to watch, not just because as a hitter, a 3,000 hits guy, who didn't start until God knows when, but aside from, started later in his career because of his career in Japan, but also as an outfielder, he was awesome.
Yeah,
I do so appreciate a great outfielder.
Well, he's
it is why Roberto Clemente would arguably be my favorite player of all time.
He's one of the smallest groups. Of course, you can dig up any statistic you want and make one of the smallest groups. He's in one of the, I'm going to say the smallest group of players that trivia question. How many guys have 10 gold gloves and a lifetime 300 batting average?
Oh my goodness! I guess Clemente would be in that one. Otherwise, you would be asking. How about Willie Mays?
Yep.
Henry Aaron?
Nope. He never had 10 gold. The list of people with 10 gold gloves is a very short one.
Yeah, I was going to say, but Henry Aaron was an outstanding outfielder. But later in his career, he didn't.
He might have won two or three, but there was always somebody kind of better. It was it was a good era. That's the thing. If you
Mickey Mantle. Get that many, or did he just get injured and wasn't able to do it?
Yeah, I don't think he got. I'm not so sure. The tough one is the 300 lifetime batting average. Well, they're both tough.
Yeah,
because the guys that there's two more. You got Mays, Clemente. I got those two.
Was Ichiro one of them?
He made it in there, and somebody just dropped out because he played 1 year too many. You probably never get it.
Now I won't get it. Tell me.
Pudge, the catcher.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking catcher, but yeah, sure.
But the other one was Roberto Alomar.
Oh yeah, Robbie Alomar was a really good second baseman.
And there's a guy I would never have. I never watched him play.
I wouldn't have thought of him either. Yeah. I would have been guessing for a long time.
But I was. I guessed three or four people, and I was right there. But the one that. If Willie Mays would have played like another month, he would have dropped out because he ended up at like 301.
Oh yeah, his last year in New York, he wasn't. He was just on the farewell tour.
And that's what happened to Pudge. I think he ended up with like 299. But my I thought my two ones that I was going to get there with, I didn't. And I was again close because they didn't make it on the Keith Hernandez. And he's like 290 something on his average, and mm-hmm. he got the 10 going Al Kaline, and the same thing with him. He ended up like 298 or something. It's that's a tough deal of a 300 lifetime batting average.
Oh yeah,
and not to mention
and to combine the two.
Well, I mean, if you are a guy like Mark Grace or something, he comes up. He was a spectacular first baseman, but he essentially had to wait till what? Hernandez retired, right? To get a gold glove, and then he won like what a bunch in a row, but he wasn't going to get to 10. Even Sandberg's got what's he got, like 8 or something, or 7? 10's a lot. I thought the question might be a sneaky one, and it would be like a pitcher in there or something with a sneaky 300 batting average, but there wasn't. Nobody And I thought maybe like a Gibson or a Greg Maddux, but he was like, you know, 230 or something.
But as good hitting pitchers, they still weren't going to hit anywhere near 300 for the career.
No. So it's yeah. So I mean, it was Greg Maddux. They were talking about him the other night, and you talk about, we were mentioning the other day about how good some of these people are. I mean, I was talking about with Lou. He's the only guy. Matter of fact, one of the Cub pitchers the other night, somebody whacked a line drive back to the mound and just happened to be right where the mitt was, and the guy caught it. Was Talion? I don't know how you pronounce that guy's name. Talion or something?
Talion.
Greg Maddux is the only guy I ever saw in all my years of watching baseball that had the reflexes to actually make a move for a line drive, which is incredibly quick. I mean, to not only see it, but to actually move for it. Usually you're trying to defend yourself is all you're trying to do. In softball, when I was young, I was never, you know, he played against me in pretty much everything. I couldn't jump, couldn't do a bunch of stuff, but I had pretty good eye-hand coordination. I caught a lot of line drives on the mound and reached for him. But then again, it's a softball. You know, it's not, you're not hitting it's not coming back at you as hard, but you're closer. But, you know, something that's one of the few things that I could do. I didn't see too many people could do. But, you know, that was like my one thing in sports. There you go.
There you go.
Everybody's got something, right?
But you know, if you only had one sporting ability, what would you go with? You could pick anyone.
I would say
this is the only thing I do well, but I really do it well.
I would say some eye-hand coordination thing, because you're good at all kinds of sports. I mean, like sports that take you the rest of your life. You're halfway decent at golf. You're halfway decent at bowling. You can play pinball. You can play ping pong. You can play pool. Those, I mean, and you're okay at the other sports. But you know, I think that some people have amazing ability to jump and do all those kinds of things. And you're trying to hit a golf ball, they're likely to hit it the wrong way. I mean, I would take the eye hand coordination over the other stuff because it ages better.
Well, a couple of other things that you could consider. One would be a jump shot, a great outside shot.
Well, you got to be able to jump to do a jump shot, don't you?
Okay. Well, let's just say a great outside shot.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's a set shot. Then they can put you on a team with good players, and if the defense has to collapse on the good players, you're just there to stretch them out.
Yep.
And so you always have a role. You could be Craig Hodges, you know, and you could do that for a long, long time. So that would be one. The other one, if there was just one thing, I had no other athletic ability, but just one thing, long snapper.
Oh yeah, oh god, yeah.
Long snapper. I mean that could be an 18-year career, making really good money, and imagine what your practice week is like.
Yeah, well, you still got to be in.
Just not that taxing.
Well, every once in a while, though, you do are supposed to make a tackle or do something, or somebody's going to black you.
But that's, you know, that's kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, it's. But yeah, there's. I actually read this thing once by some doctor. I can't remember any of the Navy's people's names. Can't remember. Said everybody, no matter who you are, unless somehow you've just been dealt. No matter who you are, you could be good at something. If you can't jump, you might end up being a distance cyclist. You might be able. I mean, not on a level where you're going to compete in the Olympics, but there's some sport someplace. Be it a rower, be it whatever it is, be it a. What are the guys with the hockey things, or the pucks they push in the Olympics? You can find a sport that you're good at. Even if you can't jump out of the gym, if you can't run like a deer, you can find something you're good enough at to enjoy. I honestly believe that. You know, it could be, what's this new sport he's playing? The wiffle balls and the paddles.
Pickleball.
I mean, there's something that you can do to enjoy sports. And I think that's very important, because it takes your mind off other stuff, you know, whatever it is. Competes with other people. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I've done with all that time in my life that I played sports. What else I would have done with it? Went out and robbed houses or what? I don't think so. But anyway,
my cousin talked me out of pickleball. He, you know, his pickleball career lasted about 15 minutes.
Why? What did he do?
He tore his Achilles tendon.
Oh God! Well, I'm sure.
First time he ever played, he tore his Achilles tendon.
Well,
don't do it. We're old, man.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, if you can warm, I think, I don't know what I think, but I think if you warm up and do some stuff, you can play. I mean,
yeah, Eric's not in bad shape.
Well, it's
You know, it was fluky, but you know, yeah. I'm sitting there going, yeah. You know, my main when it comes to athletic activity, my main goal right now is don't get hurt.
Well, that's about the truth. Of course, I don't think we run fast enough to pull a hamstring, do we?
That was the Lou Holtz line about Lee Becton.
God.
Lee Becton was a halfback, and he was you know, as halfbacks go, he wasn't fast, but he was very good. And you know, when he pulled a hamstring, Holtz said, "I didn't think he was fast enough to pull a hamstring."
Let's be futures up 175. NASDAQ futures up 18. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Howell, Ricardo on the board. S&P futures up $1.75. NASDAQ futures up 18.50. So actually, we're down a little yesterday. Down. That's wow. When I say that, I'll give it the review. Yesterday, Dow was down 38, S&P down 11, NASDAQ down 44. Not very much, considering how much we've been up, but a little bit of a pause, at least. Maybe we're going to stop here for a while, or maybe not. I got the Nikkei down 132, 0.3%. Hang Seng up 177 again. It's another 0.9%. Is they're pushing 19,553. Again, Greg looked it up yesterday. They were under 16,000, I think, in February. I think that's what he said yesterday. Shanghai up 31.54. It's a big move for those guys. That's over 1%. Chinese stock market's up after sweeping measures to boost housing sector, which is flat on its ass. I don't know what they're going to do about that. Property shares pop. What could be better than some money from government? Over Europe, DAX down 58.3%. FTSE down 29.3%. CAC around down 26.3%. So right across the board, 0.3%. Bonds. Up 2 basis points, 4.4. The Bund up 7 basis points. It's a big move. 2.51. Japan up 4 basis points, 0.96. Be interesting. Those guys look like they're going to make it to 1%. We'll see when that happens. Oil down 14 cents right here. 79.09, a little higher than the other day, but still high 70s and stuck there. Brent down a dime, 83.17. Natural gas up 3 cents, 2.52. Again, that thing has bounced off the $1.70 number like three times in the last year. Boy, what a nice trade in retrospect. A lot of trades are nice in retrospect. RBOB up 2 cents, 255. We've got gold up 640, 2391. Again, making a sneaky move toward 2400. Silver up 7 cents, 29.94. Copper up 5 cents, 493. We've got foreign exchange. We've got the euro, same thing, 108 on the British pound, 126.5. Pretty steady. We have Bitcoin up 979, 66,270. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Ricardo.
Top of the morning, Chief. Thank you. It's currently 6:33 a.m. right here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at a 60 degrees right now with a high of 71. Patchy morning fog. Otherwise, sun and some clouds. Tonight will be partly cloudy. Patchy late night fog with a low of 54 degrees. On Phoenix, Arizona, 76 degrees right now with a high of 101 degrees. Make sure you bring your shorts today. Hot with plenty of sunshine, of course. And tonight will be clear with a low of 74 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe is 13 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 30 minutes. You're going to have 27 minutes if you're going inbound Eisenhower from Wolf. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to be 19 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is going to be 31 minutes. On the sports, in the MLB, the Pirates beat the Cubs 5-4 in Chicago with a home run to left field by Edward Olivares. The Pirates play the Cubs again today at 1:20 p.m. in Wrigley Field, Chicago. The White Sox are also playing the Yankees today at the Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, New York City at 6:05 p.m. And lastly, the Tigers play the Diamondbacks at Chase Field in Arizona at 8:40 p.m. And that's all I have for you, Chief.
Kevin, you take Swanson, Horner, and about five relievers off that team. They're not an elite team anymore, are they?
They are not, as it stands now, and their whole mission is stay in the race. Stay in it. There's a lot of season left, so just stay alive.
Well, it's a good thing they got that shortstop. He's playing pretty darn good, but they didn't get him here to be a shortstop.
No, Mastroboni, he's just kind of a plug him in wherever player.
But he made some nice plays there. You wouldn't expect it was his first major league game at shortstop, and he made two really nice plays. Those guys are just good. Even the guys you think are no good are good. I mean,
yeah. Professional athletes are freakish. You know, they really are freaks.
Hey, Kevin, we wanted to tee up today. I hope our friends from Down Under are listening. We actually have, believe it or not, we do, because we get hear from them from time to time. We have a bunch of listeners in Australia, and one of the guys has sent us a real nice email the other day talking about his history and blah, 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 and he likes the show. I emailed it to Kevin because Kevin is obviously our college expert on this stuff. And there's, as we, we talk about the Chicago Teachers Union, doing God knows what and looking for massive raises to do God knows what. Every once in a while, I try and sound like an old person and mention what my mother used to tell me about education during the Depression and after that. And how the Chicago public schools used to be. I was talking to my cousin last week, and he went to Tilden Tech. He said everything you wanted to learn, you could learn there. Electric, carpentry. They even had a machine. They had a garage where they had an airplane engine in there, and they would take the airplane engine apart and put it back together again. Everything you wanted to learn in those areas, you could learn. Drawing, even like a tool and die making, stuff like that. And I think what sort of happened, Kevin, was people, if your dad or uncle or somebody owned an electrical company, maybe you worked for him on a Saturday, or maybe even after school a couple nights, and while you were in class, you learned the theory of it. And maybe at some point along the line, you could take your test to be a contractor and, actually get a license. And there was this constant, I think, constant iteration between the theory, for lack of a better term, and the practice. And what this gentleman from Australia wrote had to do with him being in essentially in med school, I think, Kevin, wasn't it? And he spent 3 years and he had, issues with a lot of stuff. I mean, not like he's a crook or anything, but he said he ended up like not finishing whatever pre-med or whatever it was. But so there was absolutely no any kind of practical training along the way where on the weekends or something, he worked at a hospital, and he goes, "I especially spent 3 or 4 years in medicine, and I couldn't deal with a hangnail if I had to. There's no practical experience whatsoever." Now, what you're doing at your place, I mean, it's not that you designed it, but you're doing the same thing that people used to do here in Chicago, only at an older age. You have people that are working, saying, "I need this skill set to complement what I'm doing." They'll take some classes with you, maybe management, maybe supply chain, maybe whatever it is. Then as they move up, they come back. There's this interplay between the two. And I wonder, especially in cities like Chicago or other places, that how getting away from that has really been a bleep up. I mean, it makes so much sense to me. Even when you're talking about, the migrants, okay, whether they should be here, shouldn't be here, whatever, they're here. Now, if they're, I don't see why schools should be closed at night. And if those guys somehow find a job, you know, with a landscaping company, with a building company, there ought to be a place, if they want, they can go at night to learn about, you know, designing backyards, or what about flowers, what about grasses, we're building a house, what are we doing? Here's how you build a house. We don't do any of that I see, Kevin, and I think it really shows. That was a long-winded explanation, but should we think outside the box and start doing some of this again?
Yes. Yeah, so I just actually spent 2 days at an event, a local event called Career Quest, where they bus in from all of the area schools in, you know, in group by group, junior high age kids. And the whole point of the event is to expose them to different kinds of careers at a young age so that they start seeing what the possibilities are. Because, you know, what you don't want to happen is you don't want somebody getting locked in on a career only to find, you know what, it turns out that's not what I want to do after all. I remember, you know, when I was in Nashville, you know, with doing kind of a tour of their academy set up there, and a woman talking about how her daughter always wanted to be an engineer. She grew up, went through high school, everything she wanted to do was geared towards being an engineer, and then she got about halfway through her engineering program in college and said, you know what, this isn't for me. So she shifted to communications. Well, okay, so she got her degree in communications, which I suppose is great if you want to get into marketing or something like that, but of course their jobs weren't plentiful. So she started working in a receptionist in a physical therapy office, and got really, really interested in it, and decided that that's what she really wanted to do. And she went back to school and became a physical therapist, and loved it. And it was, you know, having a great career as a physical therapist. And, you know, the woman's point was, if we had been able to expose her to some of these choices earlier, maybe we could have saved a whole lot of time and a whole lot of money, you know, getting her educated right. So, I think that's an important part of it right off the bat. The second is, and we really are getting away from it in this country now, but if you remember, especially through, you know, it was big on President Obama's agenda, everybody should go to college. Everybody should go to college and get a college degree. And, of course, that's the same symptom that you saw with the story of the woman who was always going to be an engineer. We keep forcing people into places where they don't need to go. For the most part, your bachelor's degree, in many cases, you get a degree in nursing, respiratory therapy, any of those kinds of fields that are really hands-on things. In those disciplines, yes, it prepares you to go to work in a specific job. Even accounting will do that. Prepare you to go to work right now in the accounting field. But say you're majoring in business, or in many cases in a lot of IT disciplines, it's not teaching you, it's not preparing you for your first job. It's prepare, you know, you got to go get a business degree. It's not preparing you for an entry-level business job. It's preparing you to be in management. And some people, you know, first of all, I'm always telling people, don't get into management unless you really, really, you know, it should be more of a calling than something you do for the money, because there's just so many headaches with it. It's not worth it. You know, there's lots of good ways to make money besides being in management. So you don't want the headaches of being in management unless you really love helping people improve and building great teams. And if that's what you love to do, then go into management by all means. But what I'm really saying, I'll use my own program as an example in supply chain. I talked to a lot of teachers over the last couple of days, and I said to them, you know, I love it when I get the A students, because the A students are really easy to teach. So that's always kind of cool when you get the A students. But I said, I really want your C students. I want the students who are not going to go into, who aren't planning to go to college, and if you let me have them for a semester or a year, I can get them some specific industry training that will prepare them to go in and be on a real quick track to, one, go to work and be productive, and number two, maybe to be on a track to be a supervisor by age maybe 20. So making really good money in manufacturing and warehousing, not in fast food, which is where half of the world winds up when they don't go to college. So, you know, you don't, you know, we want to develop people for the next job. Then when they start seeing themselves, you know, being successful, getting some promotions, you know, doing those kinds of things, then let's get them back. Then you can on-ramp back into college when you start saying, I want to be a plant manager now. Well, okay, I can help prepare you for that. That's a different, you know, a different skill set, a different curriculum. And I think that on-ramp, off-ramp type of model makes a whole lot of sense for education. You know, and it's almost like the agile project management approach. You just do everything in smaller bites, because then if you need to undo, it's not so radical. You're not undoing a lifetime's education. If you need to redo, it's doable. And that's how I've come to really look at education, is think of it in terms of on-ramp, off-ramp, on-ramp, off-ramp. You go to college and you get your college degree and you have a really nice career, good for you. But I don't think most people hit age 18 knowing exactly what they want to do or what they want to be. But they do have a pretty good idea of what their aptitudes are. And we can apply those aptitudes to preparing them to go to work, make some good money, and see where it leads.
Well, I'm going to say that right now, 90% of the people agree with your attitude towards four years of college. I'm one of the 10% that doesn't, because maybe I'm in a different world where it's not as ridiculously expensive as it is now. I mean, I mean, the same kid I'm talking about, male or female, happens to knows his dad owns an electric company or something, does some electrical theory or something in high school in addition to his, you know, college prep class. I sure wish Marist would have had some stuff like that. We didn't have anything. I mean, I would have loved taking something like that. But
yeah, but no, none of the Catholic schools did.
No,
I don't know if any of them do now. But yeah, if you
they never did. No.
Wanted anything vocational, you went to a public school.
They had woodworking classes in the Park District. I took some there, which is pretty neat. Anyway, but I always thought that college was a totally different thing, Kevin. I didn't go there to be an accountant. I mean, it was so cheap when I went that you didn't even have to think it that way. It was a way of getting the boy out of the hood to go meet different people for 4 years to learn stuff. My mother never even asked me what my major was. She didn't care. I could have walked out in history or well, I wouldn't have walked out with a language. I'd have flunked. But because I was so bad at it. They never cared. It was $3,200 a year. I was going to Notre Dame. I was meeting people. I was learning something. I was getting good grades. They never said, oh, what do you mean? How come you're not taking another accounting class? What the hell are you going to do for a job? At $3,200 a year, nobody cared. The idea was you were away. You're meeting different people. You're learning how to act on your own. You're not at home every night. You're not with the same homeboys you hang around with for your whole life. And you're learning something that you'll use one day, even if you don't think you are.
Yeah, that's a $3,200 a year, $32,000.
Or $70,000. No, now it's a big problem. Now it's a big problem. I mean, I get it, but the idea of what college was like, I mean, it wasn't this. If you came back, I mean, our buddy John Flanagan, look how bright John is on damn near every subject. I think, was John an English major or something?
Yeah.
You would never dream of sending somebody to Notre Dame as an English major now, and yet John seemed to turn out all right. I mean, and I think it's the meeting the new people from different parts of the country, taking different classes. Some you're good at, some you're not. I never, as much as some of the, well, there's a couple, I guess, kind of useless, but I don't think there was, as I've gone on, and especially going to grad school, Kevin, I could not have been, I mean, when I was at Pullman, I was the guy that they shoved in front of the consultants when they showed up. You're our guy. You can't be intimidated like by these guys like the rest of us are. You went to school, and stuff. You know, wherever you are in a board meeting, somebody comes up with some BS, It's nothing you haven't heard before. You're not going to get intimidated. Put you on a little bit of a different level. If somebody starts talking about economics, you're not an expert at it, but you at least have heard it before. You know what the guy's talking about. I think that 4 years' experience is dramatic. Not at 70 grand a year if you're going to go screw around. That part I get. I mean, because you can't be in debt the rest of your life.
I'm not discounting that at all. I think that is certainly an experience, and especially if you can afford it, do it. You know, go for it. But I think we, you know, most families have to be very practical.
Without a doubt.
And there needs to be some kind of payoff to it, and there just isn't, especially in the sort of classic liberal education. Now, unless you want to go into law or something like that. But, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, I'm going to do a liberal arts education. I'm going to go into law. Well, you know, it's the same thing. You think you're going to go into law when you start down that path at 18, and you may still be thinking you want to do that at 22, but as you start to get a flavor for it, maybe you're going to change your mind. I think those exposures are good.
But you can't.
So once again, that's why I would think that some kind of hybrid of that approach.
I would agree.
Makes a lot of sense.
Well, cutting the cost down would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But I mean,
and I'm saying this as a guy who got a business degree undergraduate and then went to graduate school many years later when I was already a working manager. But I'm also saying this as a guy who went to college as an undergraduate, kept his head above water, got good enough grades, but not great grades, and had a really, really good time in college.
I was there.
Yeah, I know you were there. and then as a graduate student, I was a very serious graduate student, and that was my enriching educational experience.
Well, you can't get to the point. A lot of the stuff I talk about, some people I guess want to hear, but I mean, if I was one of those guys who was everything has to be worth something, I would never have taken the two classes with George Stigler, a Nobel Prize winner in behavioral economics. And I would never have taken the two classes where you sat at this big conference table for two quarters about the history of economic thought, where you traced every country's what has to happen to get from this kind of society to this kind of society and how economics fits in. If my parents were paying 70 grand a year or 90, wherever the hell it is now, my mother and stepfather would have said, hey, wait a minute, what are you going to be, a high school teacher in behavioral economics? What the hell are you doing in there? Right? I mean, you can get to the point where it becomes like electrician school for accountants or marketing people or something. That's not a college education in my mind. I mean,
And keep in mind, Tom, I can do very practical material and at the same time work in some, you know, real value adds in there about, you know, what's going to make you a successful professional over the long haul. And my students hear that from me all the time. Why are we doing this? It's not in the book. And they're not asking that. I'm asking it for them, and I'm telling them I am doing what I can to make you a successful professional. As I always tell them, I want them to go out. I want them to be tremendously successful. I want them to remember my part in helping them be successful, so that they can watch out for the GoFundMe for my nursing home.
Well, right now I think we need to leave the we should leave the college part somewhat alone and concentrate on the high school part and grammar school in these cities that are falling apart, and open them up to exactly what you're doing for not only the high school kids, but for adults in the neighborhood trying to get ahead. You have the physical plants, and we're just not doing it. All we're doing is giving teachers raises that I can see. I mean, I know that's a little harsh, but I mean, this needs to be opened up, Kevin. What you're doing needs to be done at every level. And it's just not. And the money seems to be there. And what they're doing with it, I don't know. I see Chicago Vocational is the place is damn near closed.
Yeah.
What do they say?
I think too. There's a lot of stuff that revolves around it. And you know, when I think of high school teachers and grade school teachers in some of the city areas, first of all, in many areas you don't have parents who are committed to the education. You know, that helps. You know, I have a lot of students who, you know, they're first generation college, and it's a big deal. It's a family thing, and it always has been throughout their education, and I think that goes a long way. That's a piece of it. The other thing is, you know, classroom discipline. How, you know, is that something that the school management all the way up to the top of the teachers' organization, are they really committed to that? I could see being a high school teacher in the city of Chicago at many of the schools and just getting so burned out and so cynical really fast. I think that's a problem too, and that, you know, that's not easy to address.
Well,
not easy to address if you don't want to leave people behind. And my attitude always is, you know, I won't give up if a student won't give up on him or herself. Then I'm not going to give up on them, and I'll do whatever I can to help them get through a class, even if it's really difficult material for them. But sometimes they just do give up, and you know, at some point I can't help you.
Well, and a lot of the issue with the behavioral stuff comes from, you know, a million different areas.
There's a whole dynamic that's outside the schools.
I think also kids are, you know, I'm not, where's Dr. Mark when we need him? One of the ladies that, one of Audrey's friends, we had dinner, and the friend of the friend whose birthday it was as a teacher, I was talking to her, and she was saying in my class, I mean, half the kids are on Ritalin or Adderall, and the other half are stealing the kids, you know, the stuff from the kids that don't, that have it, because it's a different high. Evidently, if you don't need it, it's kind of a high. But she goes, if you could tell if the kid had his medication. He's like sleeping on the desk, and if he's not, he's bouncing off the ceiling. I mean, I don't remember any of that. I mean, the dreaded call home, well, you can call all you want. Nobody's home. I mean, it doesn't help.
We're back to beating up on Pfizer, huh?
Yeah. You know.
and the pharmacy.
Well, I mean, you have nobody at home. It's my brother's, ex-wife, but we still see her a lot, and she taught at the public schools for a while. This whole concept of like days off, I know we're skipping around, but it's kind of the same subject. She was a sub teacher. Well, inevitably, she'd end up, the person took off sick the week where they were doing like sex education or something. So she goes, I'd end up with the same crap just because nobody else wanted to teach it. And if a kid was a total, you know, goofball, you'd call home. And she goes, well, in our era, I mean, that was the kiss of death for a kid, right? And she goes, nobody's home, or I'll wake up a boyfriend who's sleeping there, doesn't care about the kid, said, what'd you wake me up for? The wife's out working, or the mother's out working, and some schlock-eyed boyfriend is home sleeping in the place. He doesn't care. Slams the phone button. She goes, a whole different world. You can't call, you know, none of the family life is the same that we remember. It's a multifaceted issue, obviously. But, you know, if you don't address it, Kevin, you're not going to fix it. I mean, people need skills, they need jobs, they need the money to be able to raise a family and not have to leave or whatever. And by the way, life is really tough even if it's done right. I can't imagine if it's done wrong what kind of trouble you're in. I mean, correct? I mean, life is not easy. I mean, the older you get, the more you realize that. And you're going to have problems. And if you start making your own problems, then you really pile onto the stuff. By the way, who do you like in the NBA? It seems like Denver, I thought they were all going all the way. And then last night, wow, what a spanking.
They got clubbed.
Yeah.
they got kind of slapped around a little, didn't they?
40 points. You know, how much of that was them resting guys in the last, I didn't make it to the end, but
That game was over in the first half. Denver ran out 9-2 at the beginning and then gave up like the next 20 points. So, and the Timberwolves never looked back. The Timberwolves have a really fine team, and if you look at the makeup of their team, they should be good.
Yeah.
They have two guys that they drafted that were first picks in the draft. And then they have a number of other first round draft picks, some of whom they acquired from other teams, and others who were, just homegrown or weren't as high profile. But you know, Aaron Gordon was and Jamal Murray were first round draft picks. That's Denver's team.
They got that Towns guy, and who's the other guy? It was almost like.
Anthony Edwards. He's only 22 years old. He was the first pick in the draft.
He's really something, that guy.
Yeah, he's a terrific player. But he was the first guy taken, and he's in his fourth season now. So, he's just starting to get as good as he's going to be. Towns has been around a little bit longer, and he's a really, really nice player. But then you get your Rudy Gobert, who's in his 30s, a veteran who's been good for a long time. Mike Conley is also, he's getting towards the end of his career, but he was a high draft pick. I think Memphis took him back in the day, so I'm not sure how Minnesota acquired him, but he's been really good for them. You're talking about, these are really outstanding basketball players, and they play good team basketball.
So is this going to be, if the Nuggets win, tonight's in Denver, though, or tomorrow night's in Denver, right?
Tomorrow night's in Denver, yep. Denver's got game 7.
Because up till now, has the home team lost every game? I think so. They won the first two in Denver.
No, last night was in Minneapolis.
Okay. I think that's the first home game that somebody's won.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, I think it was 2-2 before that.
Which is somewhat interesting. What do you make of... Why are these two guys going to debate even before the conventions? Has that ever happened before?
You know why they're doing it? Because when they threw it down and then Biden said let's bring it on. I really think the Democrats are doing this because if Biden falls on his face, if he just can't do a 2-hour debate and it looks awful, they'll have time to replace him.
Yeah, my question is, I'm not so sure Trump's up for it either. Why 2 hours? Good Lord, that's a long time.
Yeah, they don't want an audience, so they're doing everything they can to make to give Biden the opportunity to succeed. He's going to have friendly interviewers. He's going to have nobody in the studio, no crowds or anything for Trump to be working the crowd. So it's all going to be there laid out for him. But if he's not up to that task,
are they going to have an off switch for Trump if he just keeps jumping all over the guy?
Oh, Biden's thrown out the insults more than Trump has lately.
Yeah, that's true. But if
you think back to the debates last time, who was the first one to interrupt the other side? Who was the first one to interrupt in the debate?
Well, yeah, he was. I think he sort of was coached in that after the Republican debates where there were 9 people up there and Trump never let anybody else talk.
Well, actually, Biden was the second one to interrupt. Chris Wallace was the first one to interrupt.
I guess what I'm saying is...
He interrupted Trump and started correcting him.
As my feelings
not,
about...
Of course, not the moderator's job, but...
Well, my feelings about both of these gentlemen, but Biden has been degrading, shall we say, but so has Trump. I mean, he doesn't look like the same guy he was. But nobody is.
Nobody is at that age. Yeah. But I don't think it's nearly as dramatic as Biden. And I know it sounds like I'm supporting Trump, and I'm not happy with the choices either. So it isn't that. But I think.
Is there any chance they both could blow up and we get 2 new people?
I can't imagine that we'd get 2 new ones. Trump would have to be in jail, and as of yesterday, it's not looking like that's going to happen either.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll worry about that later. We got a dash, Kevin. Have a nice weekend, buddy. S&P futures up 1, NASDAQ futures up 16. Be right back. It's Carl Denninger.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Normally on the show, we talk a lot about stocks and investing, and most retail investors stick to securities products. Stocks, bonds, indices, sector indices, and options on all of the above. Recently, however, the politics and economics of our time have caused a lot of the trading and possibly investing opportunities to occur in products that are considered commodity products rather than securities products. These products, such as agricultural commodities like corn and wheat, metals like gold and silver, or even oil and natural gas, trade under a different regulatory system, have quite a different set of trading rules, and require a separate set of account agreements. We at PTI have been servicing commodities clients for over 20 years, and are an introducing broker to RJ O'Brien, one of the oldest privately owned independent futures firms here in Chicago. PTI brokers bring the same expertise to bear in the futures area. Every broker you're used to working with is commodity futures registered. So if you're looking to learn about trading commodities or are a seasoned trader, you may find it worthwhile to look at the people you already know at PTI Securities and Futures. If your next opportunity strikes in the futures area, why not be ready to take advantage of it? Check us out at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com. Futures trading involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone.
Good morning.
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JACKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us stocksandjacks at live.com. Can't buy me love.
Hello, real quick, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Cardo on the board. S&P futures up a buck and a half. NASDAQ futures up 17. We paused in the rally yesterday a little bit. We were down just a hair, but it's just a pause. We still have some creep in some of the commodities. Gold's up again today. We're trying to push 2,400. Do we have Professor Carl?
You certainly do.
Hey, I have a question for you that all my mavens here can't seem to answer. I don't have a clue, so that's why I'm asking you. We've seen gold prices creep up here, and we've seen people buying some gold in Costco for whatever reason. They're making good money on it. Keeps selling gold. Like, what are they selling, a tenth of an ounce or whatever the hell it is? Little pieces of gold bars and whatever. And evidently, they keep selling out. My question to you, where the hell does Costco buy the gold? How do you go out and say, I need, 10,000 ounces of gold? Where the hell do you buy it?
Well, I'm assuming that you buy it from any of the various foundries that, make, pamp bars and stuff like that.
I mean, it's just not like there's a gold guy down the block. I mean, it's just,
but it's like any other industrial commodity. There's companies that, they get their VIG from the, it's relatively small VIG, but it's a VIG.
The gold,
and then you,
let's say the gold you use in, and this I know you know, that's why I'm asking you, the gold you use, like on circuit boards and those kinds of things, it's still the gold that's actually used in production. Does that have to be real high grade or no?
Yeah, it is. It has
okay,
to.
Okay, does be okay.
Correct. It's 24 karat. It's essentially pure. And the reason it's used in critical electronics is that gold is essentially an inert material in terms of reactivity. So if you have contacts that are made with it, then the inevitable corrosion that otherwise will cause flaky connections over time doesn't happen. And that's the reason for it. Okay, I mean, with vehicles, the manufacturers essentially solved that problem 30-ish years ago, but not by using gold because it's too expensive. So what they did instead is that all your modern, if you go look at like the oxygen sensors on your car or something, which are, they're underneath where all kinds of garbage gets sprayed at them all the time, right? Because, it's the bottom of the car.
Yep.
All those connectors have a double O-ring style seal inside them. So when you take them apart, you'll notice that there's a rubber seal in there. So when you, and the wires going in at the ends, which obviously, would be another way for contamination to get in there. Those are sealed too. It's synthetic. It's not actual natural rubber anymore, obviously. But the idea being that when they're plugged in and connected together, there's no way for anything to get in there. And so you don't have the problem so much. But your typical open Molex connector, it's open to the atmosphere. And so the only way that you can prevent corrosion in that kind of a situation, or, like on a PC board or in a phone or whatever have you, since you really realistically can't hermetically seal the entire thing, and you'd have problems if you did with changes in air pressure, as people went from one place to another, you use gold on the contact surfaces. And that's the way you solve the problem. Very effective, but obviously it's not cheap. But that's the industrial use. Used to be that we made crowns and dental work out of it as well. Partly because it was non-reactive in the mouth with the various things that you ate and drank. But the other reason is that it's reasonably well matched in terms of expansion coefficient to teeth. And so that's the other big bugaboo with, you know, with anything that has to be bonded to something, is that you don't want something that has a wildly different expansion coefficient, because it will break loose the, you know, the bond between the two things.
Yeah, well, some of the stuff they do with that, I know the coming from Notre Dame, the Golden Dome, it looks, I mean, it's actually gold. But I read somewhere like years ago, they redid the dome, but the foil, it's like a gold foil. It's so thin, it was only like, was it 10 ounces for the whole dome? Or some incredibly small amount. And yet it was all new.
Yeah, yeah.
How the hell do you do that?
So, I mean, there's, you know, that's one of the things there's this nostalgic view of gold as a, you know, because it was a monetary metal for a long, long period of time, and it was a monetary metal because it was easy to determine whether or not it had been contaminated, and its non-reactivity was a big part of the reason for that. Okay, in that if you alloyed it with something, in other words, you decreased its purity, that was trivially detectable by displacement versus mass. And you could also determine whether or not it had been adulterated by putting a little bit of acid on it. If it started to fizz, guess what? That ain't real. So I mean, that was one of the reasons, and being non-reactive, it didn't disappear on you due to natural forces either. So it was, I mean, it had those properties that made it very usable in that kind of a realm. And, you know, in a world where we didn't have electronics and, you know, a balance beam scale was some reagents was about the limit of your ability, you know, to verify things. That's a very useful set of properties. Very useful.
Kyle, I don't know if you were listening, but Kevin and I were talking about, because thankfully from a letter from a listener down in Australia, about how we can kind of re-common sense the education system. And some of the stuff that you're always talking about, where, you know, now we're having, this stuff, all, it sounds like there's all the different subjects, but they're not. They all kind of tie together. We had a lady that worked with us years ago at PTI, and she was, she came in, she was back when you had to know how to type. She was good at that and was a receptionist, and, you know, we had a lot more people at the time. And pleasant as all get out. She was almost like an Edith Bunker. There wasn't a bad bone in the lady's body. And she took one of these online, they first came out, like nursing classes. And she paid for it, and of course, well, paid for it. They got her a loan, one of those kinds of places. And,
right.
And she ended up in some kind of debt. But the snafu was, she actually learned a lot about the theory of nursing, but at the end of the day, and again, she did this on her own, it had nothing to do with us, because she wanted to be a nurse. I mean, she was doing this, you know, in the meantime. And we were happy as for her as an employee, we were happy she was going to be a nurse, and all of a sudden she get to the end of this thing. Now, I don't know, whatever school it was, of course they blamed it all on the school, I don't know if people went to jail, and I don't know what happened to her debt. I mean, I don't even know. She ended up getting married, moving out of town, we lost track of her, but at the end of the day, they didn't have the ability to do the field work, the school that she had, because basically, the University of Chicago, Rush, Northwestern, all your hospitals had their own nursing program and only let their people train in their hospital.
Right.
Which, for lack of a better term, sucks. Then there was no... I mean, you're always talking about combinations that shouldn't happen, right? If somebody presents you with, you know, 25 nursing or 10 nursing students have completed something and they're willing to pay to get trained in a hospital environment, for them to say, no, we only take our people, yet another, you know, Sherman Act issue, right?
Oh, yeah, but you know what? No, Chief, nobody... Look... there's the bleeding is starting now about how there's no one serious has come up with a way to deal with this debt problem that the United States government has. That's a load of BS. No one's serious. Let's see.
I'm talking about all of it.
Okay. But no one's serious, huh? I seem to remember that Wiley, which is a rather serious academic publisher, published a book I wrote about 13, 14 years ago now on exactly that subject. To a large degree, not only that subject, but that was certainly a huge part of it, and went through the mathematics and laid forth some fairly broad strokes, because you get into the weeds with the book for wide distribution, people just go, what?
Yeah.
Alright, so I mean, I actually, when I went through the process with their editors, there was an awful lot that got the hatchet, because it was essentially you won't get anybody to read the entire thing if you do that, and since they're paying the freight to have it printed, well, guess what, they call the tune, that's fine. But then a number of things, I've got that infamous those two articles, actually, one's linked to the other, on fixing healthcare for everybody in the United States, resolving it, period, end of conversation, it's over, the problem is gone. You can have it. Anybody else can have it. We can all afford it. Now, of course, the problem with doing it, and it absolutely would work. I've never run into anybody who's read that and analyzed it and said, "Oh no, it won't work because," and then come up with something other than a political answer, right? The political answer is, well, but if you did that, there'd be an instantaneous 15% of the population that's currently working would lose their jobs. Well, that's true. They would. However, the productivity increase by getting rid of the parasitic drag that is currently there as a result of this, and what that would do within a very short period of time, I mean, sure, there'd be short-term economic pain that would come out doing it, but the competitiveness shift in the United States as a whole, oh my God. All right. I mean, the sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about with all those jobs going to Mexico, it would be the exact opposite with companies domiciling back here into the United States, and it would happen instantaneously.
What do you think when you just said that? Now you got me back to a couple classes I had at the University of Chicago, which what Carl's talking to now about it's a very serious economic principle. When you talk about efficiency and so forth, and say, for instance, and I'm trying to take it back to economics class 101, if I can, Carl, if I don't screw it up. But Carl's saying if you introduce more efficiencies into even something like the healthcare system, most of us would say, wow, these hospital groups are really top-heavy. And if we made them a little more competitive, or if we actually used more of a cost system that was better, you might get rid of, let's pick a number, 20% of, I use the term, overhead meaning people at the top that you really don't need. I mean, you probably don't need five other people for every doctor, or 10 or whatever the hell they have. Maybe you get away with 8 or something. That all of a sudden these guys are out of a job. So these guys and ladies. Now, economic theory would say that the efficiency you pick up, that instead of PTI paying $2,200 or $2,500 or whatever today would be for somebody's health insurance, that might drop to $1,800. Okay, so now the other $700.
Well, you should just take a zero off of it, and that would be about right.
Okay, but I'm saying that, but in principle, even if it's 20%, it's now $2,500. Now it's $2,000. In theory, we could go around everybody in a place and give them a $500 raise.
Well, that's right.
Or we could take it into profit, and at the end of the year, pay it out to the shareholders. It gets back into society somehow. So now there's extra dough available for people who didn't have it. Let's say simple, we just give everybody a $500 raise. Now that $500 is probably, if it goes into savings, okay, it means that savings equals investment, that somebody is going to be able to maybe pick up more money from a bank and open up a whatever they're going to open up, another manufacturer.
Right, it's diffuse.
But now the question is, so those people who just got fired, there should, in theory, be now people hiring some other place. Now the difference is, now whether or not the same person has the same skill set, how quickly that moves. That's when you're
well, it's not instantaneous, no. Chief. I mean, and nobody. I mean, I've never argued that it would be, and I don't know anybody of that is sane that would argue that it would be. It's not
right.
There's going to be a period of adjustment. There's going to be a period of pain. Okay, but I look at economic history in the United States. We had one very serious economic dislocation where the government did not tamper with the market to try to block it, okay? And that was 2021. It was right after World War One. All the people came back into the United States.
1921.
Huh?
1921.
Correct.
You said 2021.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah, 1921. It was the deepest economic decline, and the bankruptcy, the number of bankruptcies that occurred were off the rack. Okay, it was insane. And basically what had happened was that we'd just gotten done with a war, if you remember.
Yeah.
Okay. And the shift back was extremely chaotic. And so when this happened, people, they were out over their skis. They went broke. And this, by the way, the Treasury Secretary's name was Hoover, went and
said... It was a brilliant man, by the way.
He said, we have to stop this from happening. Well, he couldn't get anywhere with the administration. And they said, no, we're not doing that. So all the crash and the bankruptcies occurred. And it was the largest change in GDP... GNP, because they didn't measure it the same way then. It was called GNP instead. That has ever been recorded in the history of the United States. However, it was too short to be considered a depression. And the reason is that two quarters later, the recovery began, literally 6 months. And within about a year, all of the lost employment was recovered. The economy was essentially back to full employment. The realignment took place on its own terms very rapidly because people still needed stuff. Okay, you still had to make things for people, right? I mean, the demand didn't go away. And the largest gain in GNP ever recorded in the history of the United States occurred.
Well, those are...
So for those people who say that if the government cuts this out and stops the BS... that it is the end of America. You're wrong. We have proof of this in the form of our country's history.
We could have a real nice debate on that one, because that happened. It's happened after a few wars. By the way, almost the same thing happened in the Civil War.
Well, it's true, and then you have the crime of 1873. That people talk about when silver was demonetized.
What Carl's explaining here is, it's not just the wars. The history of the war is not the Civil War, but certainly World War One. We not only were fighting over in Europe, we were supplying Europe, right? So we had an amazing amount of companies that weren't just making bullets for our guys; they were making bullets for other guys too. So. And we had a huge amount of advancement in the first rudimentary tanks, the machine guns, the metallurgy, all that stuff were not to mention aircraft, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you come back, and now the bullet manufacturer gets a notice that said, we don't need no more stinking bullets.
Well, right. We're not using them at that kind of rate anymore. Yeah.
By the way, do something else. Okay, well, the next day, the do something else is you guys are all fired, right? But you also come back with a lot of people that are now making families pretty much rapidly, because everybody's 22 years old. And, oh, by the way, all the inventions that you now have are now applicable to washing machines. I'm not going to say TVs, but radio.
Right.
All of a sudden, there's massive progress in inventions in wartime, there always is, that somehow is now applied to things domestically. Automobiles. I mean, if you, Carl, you'd be absolutely fascinated, and if you haven't already done it, two days, if you're in the Midwest, I'll meet you there. The Auburn Duesenberg Cord Museum in Auburn, Indiana. That's the name, Auburn Duesenberg Cord Museum. You get to see all these incredible cars. I mean, hell, you know, look, I could get lucky driving around in Auburn. In Auburn, to put it grossly, those things were absolute works of art. But in the place, I went once and just looked at the cars. Well, the next time I went back, I spent a whole day. There's a huge history of the automotive industry. And what looked like a car in 1908, and by the time you got to 1921, the advancements in 13 years, there was a whole industry there, for God's sake. Same thing in aviation. The difference between, you know, the planes flying around in the movie The Blue Max the first plane was, what, 1912, was the Wright Brothers? By 1921, they're where? 20,000 feet? 25,000 feet? I mean, the advancements were... It didn't take more than 6 months for that factory to reopen, not making bullets, but making something else.
And that's the thing, though, is those kinds, if the government stays out of it, and, you know, this is, you take a look at where the problem is, if you analyze this, you just leave politics out of this, you just take a mathematical analysis to this thing, which is what I've been advocating that we do for a long time. And it goes all the way back to, I was running MCS, I could see these same patterns, okay? We're talking about the 1990s here, okay? And these same patterns were in the budget data. They have not changed. And what was going to happen was evident even then. And I was raising a stink about it back then because it was obvious what was going to occur. And that at that point, the data had been clear for 15, 20 years. Okay, so it goes back that far. And the reality of it, though, is that you have a corrupted process that has gotten imbued into our government. And every time one of these industries finds themselves with their back up against the wall because people can't pay, right? You just simply get to the point that people can't pay for it anymore. They go get something changed in government policy, either at a state or a federal level, and voila, you know, the spigot gets turned on for them, right? Nobody turns around and says, you made this bed, you figure out how to sleep in it, and by the way, if you can't, somebody will take your plant and make something else useful with it, okay? Because you're going to go bankrupt, you're going to end up selling that stuff for 5 cents on the dollar on the steps of the courthouse. And when you do, I'm going to come buy it for 5 cents on the dollar. And at 5 cents on the dollar, I'm more competitive than the other guys in the business. And therefore, I win and they lose. And by the way, that's called productivity, and it's how we advance as a society. It's why we have all the things we have today.
There is zero argument against what you're saying, except there's a huge argument against it. How do I just say that? It's the human element, Kyle. You never, even though I love jabbing you to get more knowledge out of you, because I know there's so much in there. Let's put it this way: if you and I somehow or another, the Red Sea parts, and the two of us end up, let's say, either in the governor's chair in Illinois or the mayor's chair in the city, but it's too big of a job, so we're there together. It's going to take the both of us, as they say in the South Side. And we sit there and we go, okay, we've got these problems. And these are, you know, we got the CTA, we got the police, we got crime all over the damn place, we got people leaving, we got empty areas, we've got migrant people, we've got all this stuff. Now, you and I talk about it here, and by the way, we're both in huge agreement, you from maybe the more business side, me from the economic side. And these things are just sucking the lifeblood out of the place, right? And we understand that. Yet, I don't know that the first thing on our agenda, I mean, I'm going to sit there and say, wait a minute, Commonwealth Edison or Peoples Gas, I see the price of gas going down, actually it's going up lately. Commonwealth Edison probably charges 25% more than they should, and they're sucking the lifeblood out of people, and have for a century and a half. Because look at what you pay for electricity in Wisconsin. Look what you play, maybe even in New York, maybe somewhere else. You know, we'd have to have a study being done, but it's probably cheap.
11 cents a kilowatt hour right here, Chief.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably cheaper. Okay, so now you and I can say, all right, now what are we going to do tomorrow? And taking apart Northwestern, University of Chicago, Commonwealth Edison, People's Gas, we can rattle off the names. Who wants to go first, you or me? I mean, Dr. J and I used to do the show all the time on the score and everything, and John's a great guy to do a show with. So one day he's railing about the tax code. And I said, okay, John, we both know that there's discontinuities. How's that for an economic term in the tax code? Here's my assignment for you. By the way, there's a restaurant show here in Chicago this week, one of the biggest shows. I want you to scuttle your behind over there and give a big speech about there's no way on earth that restaurant meals for businesses should be deductible for taxes. If it's a guest, you know, it's a business associate, you get to take $25 off, no booze, no nothing. Why should you be sitting there as a business guy next to me in some fancy joint and your bill is $300, but it's really $200, where mine's $300 and I don't get to deduct it? I mean, that's crazy. I said, if you survive that little encounter, if you make it out of McCormick right. Place, then I want you to go over to the NFL and say, none of the skyboxes, none of the tickets to football games are going to be deductible. Now, if you make it back here for tomorrow's show, you're welcome back.
Yeah, somebody doesn't hang you from the lamppost.
Yeah, on the way back. Yeah. I mean, these have become so involved that they just wouldn't be a fight we'd pick on day one. Because we'd say...
Well, except, see, here's the problem.
Not saying we shouldn't, by the way. Somebody has to somewhere. I get it.
No, Chief, you have to, and you have to... And it goes back to a first principle that I have guided my business work from the beginning of it, okay? Which is that 80% of any problem is easy to solve. It's the last 20 that's impossible. And the closer you get to the, you know, the last 1%, the harder it gets. Okay, it's exponential. The problem with this is that we always politically go after that 1%. Always. I don't care which party you're talking about. They're always doing that. All right? They never want to go after the 80, which is where the actual difference gets made, because that is going to rattle everybody's sacred cow, right? Oh, yeah. Every sacred ox is going to end up getting gored and burnt. And so we can't do that, because good God. But you know what? We can screw this little guy over here, because he's the 1%.
Oh, yeah.
He won't cause us to lose our jobs, okay? Because he can't. He doesn't have enough economic power to do it.
Hold that thought, Carl. We got to do a break. SP Viewers up 3 and Nancy Viewers up 25. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at ptisecurities.com. That's ptisecurities.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Well, no thanks, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. Ricardo on the board. SP Futures up 375. It looks like we're doing the upside creep here again. SP Futures up 26. Dow Futures up 16. I don't see in the Dow. I've got nothing really doing much of anything. Microsoft up $1.76. Microsoft goes up every day. They must be going to own the world someday. I got Amgen up $1.61. Everything else, a lot of green, but nothing crazy. To either direction. Over in Asia, the Nikkei down 132. It's 0.3%. Hang Seng up, though, up another 177.9%, 19,553. Shanghai up 31%, 31.54. I know I sound like a broken record on this stuff, but it's all about government money. Chinese stock market's up after sweeping measure to boost housing sector property shares pop. Let's throw some money at some people. Let's have their shares go up. That's our recipe, and it's going to be that way for like as long as I guess they can do it. DAX up 69, I'm sorry, down 69.4%. FTSE down 32.4%. CAC around down 37.4%. Talk about universal across the board, a little bit bearish, not much. Yesterday, we actually had a down day, crazy. Dow down 38, not much. S&P down 11, again, not much. And NASDAQ down 44. So we're off our all-time highs here by a little bit, but it looks like we're trying to head right back there again. Bonds up 2 basis points, 4.39. The Bund up 7. 2.50, and Japan up 4.96 now, making it towards this 1%, maybe. Oil up a dime, 79.33. Run up 4 cents, 83.31. Natural gas up 2 cents, 2.51. Very quiet in the oil patch lately, between 78 and 80 and a half, really now for a while. RBOB up 2 cents, 2.55. We've got gold starting to rally here again, 7.7 up, 23.93. We got 2,400. Can we make it? Silver up 14 cents, 30, over 30 bucks. Silver's actually been a better performer than gold here. Copper up 9 cents, maybe the best performer of all. 497, trying to push $5. We've tried to get along some copper, but it's a huge contract in the CME, so we really don't have anybody doing that. We've had a couple of copper stocks that have gone up some, but really did not get into much in there as I would have liked to. Foreign exchange. Euro unchanged 108, and the British pound unchanged 126.5. We've got Bitcoin up 1,066.384. Carlo, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Top of the morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at a very nice day today, actually. Quite sunny, 62 degrees right now with a high of 71. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Patchy morning fog, otherwise sun and some clouds. Tonight will be partly cloudy, patchy late night fog. Lows 54 degrees here in Chicago. Over Phoenix, Arizona, we got 76 degrees right now with a high of 101 degrees. Hot with plenty of sunshine, and tonight will be clear with a low of 74. Onto traffic in Chicago. If you're coming inbound, Kennedy from Monroe is going to be about 13 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook is about 30 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 27 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is going to be 31 minutes. On the sports in the MLB, the Pirates beat the Cubs yesterday, 5-4 in Chicago, with a home run to left field from Edward Olivares. The Pirates play the Cubs again today at 1:20 p.m. in Wrigley Field, Chicago. The White Sox are playing the Yankees at the Yankee Stadium today at 6:05 p.m. in the Bronx. And the Tigers play the Diamondbacks at Chase Field in Arizona at 8:40 p.m. That's it. That's all I got for you, Chief.
Carol, I think at some point I have to go to a Yankee game in the new stadium. I went to the old one like 3 times. I got to try the new one. It's America, Yankee Stadium, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. Maybe.
You ever been there?
Nope.
I was at the old one like 3 times. Once in a, well, they have a skybox, but it wasn't. The skybox was actually behind the grandstand, so it was not. You kind of watch it on TV.
And you go to the skybox for the free booze. And
well, they had the free booze. It was the. By the way, did I ever tell you that story? I was on the board, and I was the chairman of the marketing committee, so it was one of these big industry, you know, all the member firm people came out there, and you have your, shall we say, conspiratorial mindset only because you've seen it in life. I don't think you read a book, and all of a sudden, because somebody else saw it, you're believing it. You've seen it. And I feel the same way. We went to this skybox. And so guess who is the CBOE? Talk about a story. They wanted to drag, you know, as if, you know, the member firm people won't come and eat and drink for free at the Yankee Stadium. Of course they will. Well, we decided to the chairman of the CBO, decided to fly out an old Yankee star from Chicago to sign autographs. Who would you think that would have been?
I don't know.
Remember the name Moose Skowron?
Yes.
He was on all those teams with Mantle and Maris and so forth, but he was a champion of the Chicago softball leagues, and he was, you know, basically recruited out of that or out of high school and came back and was a huge star. Huge man. I mean, in terms of, the guy was, well, I don't know what I was at the time, but he was probably 75. You wouldn't have messed with him. Still nothing but just a big rock. Anyway, so he was out there, and this was right when the long-term capital fiasco was.
Oh.
So it was kind of that week, and all of a sudden this was one of these, when it was Russian debt turned into long-term capital, right? And I forget the details, but what ended up happening was people and I knew a lot of these firm guys. They knew I traded in the OEX, right? The OEX pit with 350 people in it was the second biggest exchange in the world. It was bigger than the rest of the CBO combined. It was bigger than the Amex, was bigger than the Philly, bigger than any other exchange except the New York Stock Exchange. That one pit. That's how much was traded in their nominal value and notional value. And if you were going to trade, that's what you traded. Okay, so these guys came in, they had just, this long-term capital market was getting its ass kicked, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, it kind of turns around, and on a Friday morning of expiration, it was only expirations monthly then, on a Friday morning of expiration, the Fed in the middle of the morning, says, we're like lowering the discount rate, which, when you have expiring options in 4 hours, is a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a huge deal. So, fortunately, everything was kind of bearish, and I was set up for the downside, but I never did trust these people, so I had enough calls, out-of-the-money calls, just in case. So I had a really nice day trading in the pit, but I think my position, something like lost, the downside of the position, lost on this turn, somewhere in the neighborhood, you know, I had a pretty big account in those days. I'm going to say 270 grand. The out-of-the-money calls I bought just in case made like 271.
So it was okay, like, that was a fortuitous.
It was a total dead even, and then I made, you know, pretty good money trading that day. I mean, probably 10, 15 grand back when you could do that. But some of my best friends essentially were carried out, never to come back again.
A lot of people end up on their shield that day.
Well, obviously, you know, somebody comes in and the thing's trading 230, and somebody buys the 236 calls, which was a huge move on one day, and you sell them to them for, you know, 30 cents or 3/8 in those days, and all of a sudden they close at $7 or something. You know, you got a problem.
Right.
You got a real problem. So one of the guys says to me, out of the blue, we were sitting there talking to Moose, and all of a sudden the crowd kind of moves away, and it's just the two of us. The guy says, by the way, one of my friends from the Fed called me, and he said, I knew we'd be meeting with some CBO guys tonight, and I told him, yeah, one of the guys trades in the OEX, meaning me. He says, they wanted to ask how bad it was for the people in the pit. And immediately, the hair goes up in the back of my neck, and I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, they refloated. They essentially led a few firms that were in the deep trouble with the long-term capital. They let them know about the move like a few minutes before. So they were able to buy some spoos or buy some options or whatever.
So basically the bottom line was that they bailed those people out at the expense of the people who got carried out of their shield.
And anybody else would just happen to be in the market.
Essentially, they screwed people out of the money to save someone else.
Right, exactly.
Right, that's the essence of what they did.
That's exactly. And I said, well, yeah, it's two or three of my friends, one of them, a lady we'd gone skiing with and so forth. She'll never trade again. The guy's all, So the guy says to me, so it wasn't really all that bad. Well, for them it was. I mean, what are you talking about? It wasn't that bad. Me, yeah, I escaped. Yeah. I escaped the skin of the luck of my tooth or something. But you know, probably most people escape somehow. He goes, yeah, I just want to know how bad it was. I'm going, how does anybody get to do that? I think it must be done more than the one time, I guess is my question.
It's done all time, but you know, this is the essence of where the problem lies, though, Chief, because people think that Obamacare, for example, was all about, you know, health equity for people in America. Okay, I mean that's how it was sold, right? That was Pelosi's and, you know, everybody else's. That was their thing. They put this huge bill together, and I think I'm one of the only people that read the whole thing before it was actually voted on. Probably one of a handful in the United States. I stayed up all night because it was one of those you got to pass it to find out what's in it deals, right?
Oh yeah.
And when the text got published, I stayed up all night. I had my four screens at the time that I used as a trading console, which you have to do for a bill like that because there's 400 different references in there that are, take this two sentences out of this piece of the law at this place and insert this, all right? Which means you now have to open another window and look up that one in order to figure out what the devil that, you know, those four lines do, right?
Yeah.
And you have to do that through the entire document. So you can't just read the bill and understand it. You have to read it and chase all the cross-references, and there's dozens. So I stayed up all night doing it. I had the coffee pot going, and what I realized was that this had absolutely nothing to do with subsidies or, you know, it had nothing to do with helping people. The entire design of the bill was to prevent the collapse, which was impending and occurring right then, in the entire scheme that started with Ronald Reagan and EMTALA. And EMTALA was passed. EMTALA is the law that says that if you're having a heart attack, you get taken to the hospital. They cannot even ask if you can pay before they treat you.
Right. I've gone through a few times, and I won't do it now, but a few times of how hospitals used to get paid before Obamacare. It was a total mess, and it was falling apart.
Right. But Ronald Reagan passed that. He signed that law, and the reason he signed it was that a handful of people, it was a literal handful, it was a couple of dozen times, that somebody got badly screwed and ended up dead as a result of being able to get care. All right. It didn't happen very often, but when it did, it made the news. Because, you know, here's a guy clutching his chest and he's got no ability to pay, and you tell him go stuff it, or you tell him he's got to go across town to the charity hospital, which is, you know, 15 miles away, and he dies before he gets there.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
So this was, you know, this was the problem it was supposed to solve.
The insurance, real briefly, how a hospital, they used to essentially seriously overcharge the people with the Cadillac insurance to cover all the people that weren't insured.
Which is illegal.
Well, but it also was running out of gas because the insurance companies were saying, I know we're cutting deals. So they started refusing to pay. Hey, what says here, world's top golfer Carl Denninger arrested, Scotty Scheffler arrested for assaulting officer at PGA Championship event. How could he assault an officer while he's playing golf?
Well, I don't know. That sounds kind of interesting.
But here's, I think, what happens, Carl, because we've been talking with Kevin and with you about economic theory piling into politics. And so Obama, first of all, Hillary tried to do something.
Right.
I'm going to say her plan probably was better than Obama can, but of course, it's like when they're impeaching Bill and he's, you know, chasing girls around the White House.
Well, no, that was no. What Hillary essentially tried to do is turn us into Europe.
Well, I'm saying whatever it was, it gets shouted down.
But that's true.
But she at least, she and Bill, and I'm sure other people, at least recognized that the system was not sustainable the way it was. Okay, I mean, I knew that, and so did you. I mean, I think. Back those days. And then all of a sudden, George gets in, was perfectly happy, of course he had the 9/11 stuff, was perfectly happy to ignore the whole thing for 8 years, basically what he did.
Right.
So he was no help. So now Obama comes in and he promises this, quote, solution. Well, if you and I were at his side and a bunch of other people, and there probably were people there saying, you not only got to fix the payment part of it, you got to fix the cost part of it. Well, every one of those pages that you're talking about, you probably got three health industry lobbyists sitting on your friggin' lap, and every page would have been a fight. To finally, the president, I'm not saying the fight shouldn't have been waged. You and I both know it probably should have been. But if you and I are sitting there going, hey, guys, I want my friggin' bill. I promised the country a bill, and if you got to give in to these guys somewhere along the line to get it done, we'll fix it later, or some other crap, which they never do. There's that side of it, too, right? I mean, unfortunately. Am I correct? I mean,
I understand that aspect of it, Chief. Okay, but the problem is this.
We understand it. We don't agree with it. But yes, that's. I mean,
no, I get where they were coming from with that. I understand. You know, the sausage gets made in really disgusting ways in all governments. Okay, and you know, our Congress is no different anywhere else. But the problem with it is that you take a look at, for example, this fiasco in the 1970s with the DTP shots.
Yeah.
All right. That led to the immunity that currently exists for vaccine manufacturers in the United States.
Is that, unfortunately never made it from Europe to here on the babies? Or was that something?
No, that was thalidomide. That right, was, okay. Oh my God. That was one intrepid FDA employee, a woman, by the way, who spotted the data. She spotted the problem in the data over in Europe, and she slammed the door on it. And during those days, she was able to do that. Now, today, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Oh, some lobbyist would hit up somebody, and she'd be fired.
That's right. She'd be fired, and that, you know, the drug would come over here, and it would screw everybody. But the door got slammed by one person who spotted the data, spotted the problem. And as a result, we only had a handful of those kids that got hosed like that in the United States, whereas over in Europe, it was a disaster. So the DTP thing, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which got passed because the pharmaceutical companies threatened to cut off all vaccine manufacturing if they didn't get it, there's a 75-cent, I think it's 75 cents per dose tax that pays into a fund that then is used to compensate kids who get injured. Okay, now that sounds sort of reasonable, right? I mean, it's an insurance scheme, basically. All right, except part of the bill included an accountability requirement to prevent it from happening again, that each lot had to be tracked for adverse events. It had to be officially reported into Congress on an annual basis. Okay, this is actually in the statute. This isn't somebody's interpretation. It's there. Not one report has ever been filed. Not one. And no enforcement has been done. So we do not know. We do not know if, in fact, these things are safe, because the data has never been presented. It has not been challenged. It has not been collected. It has not been disseminated. Nobody knows. And this happened in the 1980s. It's 40 years later, and kids do get screwed. The question is the risk-reward benefit worth it? Okay, that's always the question with anything. Is you got to pay something? Hey, listen, nothing is completely safe, ever. Is it worth it? Electricity isn't completely safe. There are some kids, you know, every now and then somebody gets electrocuted, right? I mean, it happens. But we all like having power in our house. Is the risk and the reward, where's the balance? Well, you look at the same thing that's going on right now with these drugs, these weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, and there are others, okay? All of those. The data is that you have about 1 in 6 people has an adverse event that is so severe they have to stop using it. Okay, it's not just that something bad happens. It's bad enough that they have to stop. All right, so, you know, paralyzed stomach or whatever have you.
Well, stop using it's one thing. Croquin's another. I mean, how bad are they?
Now, wait a minute. Some of those are permanent life-changing events, all right? If you get permanent stomach paralysis out of this, you're screwed, all right, forever. All right, now,
what is stomach paralysis?
Oh, your stomach doesn't empty. basically makes it impossible for you to properly absorb nutrients.
Oh, it, okay, so it doesn't, it's an absorption thing, it's not a muscle thing where stuff doesn't get passed further.
Well, no, it is. Yeah, it, that's the whole problem.
It's both of them?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
I mean, if that happens to you, oh my God, okay. So, that is a severe side effect. That's not, I puke once in a while, right?
Okay, right, well, that's, whatever. Okay, now, I love where you're going here, but we can both. I'm saying, what is the.
Hold on, a minute.
Keep going.
Here's the other half of that. 1 in 12, according to the data at this point, and this is, by the way, is from a study that ran for 4 years, so it's actually pretty, you know, it's pretty good, and it's a huge study. It's got a huge number of people in it. 1 in 12 avoided a non-fatal heart attack or stroke. So you are twice as likely to have something really terrible happen to you as you are to avoid something really terrible. All right, now both of these are non-fatal. All right, so we're not talking about this kills you.
A lot of bad things can happen and not be fatal.
Well, I understand that, but the point is that a non-fatal heart attack is very bad, but it's not fatal. Okay,
it means they caught it in time.
No, it means that you had the heart attack, but it didn't kill you.
All right, so you didn't even know you had it, or
no, you had it, but this is the data is that 1 in 12 of the people who were taking these drugs, this is, again, over 4 years, okay, over a four-year period of time, 1 in 12 avoided a non-fatal heart attack. All right, now, I'm not so sure I trust that data, because avoiding something is kind of, I mean, that's a little nebulous, right? So, I mean, that might not be accurate, because how do you measure something that didn't happen, right? But that's the power of statistics, is if you have a big enough sample, you actually, the data's probably pretty good. But 1 in 6 got screwed, seriously screwed. And so you are twice as likely to get seriously screwed as you are to avoid a serious screwing. Now, in both cases, you don't die. Okay. However, in both cases, we're talking about serious stuff. We're not talking about, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable, or I got gas, or, you know, whatever. No. We're talking about really bad things that require serious medical intervention.
What in terms of the review stuff you're talking about, and I always talk about whatever bill it is, be it, you know, Trump's tax cut, be it Biden's, right, you know, infrastructure, and it, you would think that at a period of 6 months or a year later, somebody would, you would force people in Congress like this review. I'm sure there's reviews of military stuff. I'm sure there's a list from here to the parking lot where I park my car of lists of stuff Congress is, quote, supposed to do. That, and yet the people I see here from Congress, some look like they're fairly busy and kind of guys that, you know, put work in a day. A couple, they don't even know. I can only imagine if you put a tracker on them like you would somebody's car, and see what they did all day.
Oh my God!
They're not a maybe even capable, but surely not willing to do a half of the stuff, a tenth of the stuff they're supposed to be doing on a daily basis, according to reviews and other kinds of stuff. Now, you can say a staffer does it or whatever, maybe they do or maybe they don't. I don't even know if every guy there was a Richard Nixon who supposedly started every day at 7 and didn't stop working late at night. I mean, as much as maybe people didn't like the guy was a serious outlier when it comes to lack of sleep and hour days and so forth. Even if you had everybody was like that, could you even do the stuff they're supposed to do?
Well, we all get down to the same basic thing at the end of the day, which is that when corruption is never going to go away. It's an inherent part of every human endeavor, right? Trying to bribe lawmakers through legal and through foul and fair means, super PACs and things like this. You know, I said, like that email that you sent around the other day, right, about the attempting to influence things. I have a serious problem with the fact that this can be done confidentially. Right? Yep. And I don't care what the means is. We have a First Amendment in this country, which means you have a right to speak, and that includes speaking to lawmakers.
Oh, right? the memo had to do with a bunch of businessmen supposedly getting together in New York and influencing the mayor to break up the
Palestinian protests.
Palestinian protests. And I'm sitting there going, do these guys have a private Zoom room somewhere that they all get together?
Well, this is I don't have a problem with businessmen getting together and saying this is bad for business, we want it stopped. Okay? I don't have a problem with that. You can make your argument. Okay,
but through normal communication channels, not back channels that you and I don't have.
That's exactly, but you know what? Yeah. Super PACs are the same thing because they don't have to disclose their donors.
I was gonna say something very intelligent. I forgot what it was. The having to do with this is kind of communication through the. Remember the guy who was on CNBC forever? Is an older dude. He's been dead since probably before COVID. But his major thing was he was one of the major guys in the Resolution Trust. You know what I'm talking about. He might be dead 6-7 years, but he was. And whenever they ask him about the Resolution Trust, if you ever want to see something like really screwed up, read some of it. Go online, and there's still some stuff around, even though people seem to be getting rid of it. About the one of my first clients, or one of PTI's first clients, was a older, very wealthy gentleman from Arizona, where a lot of that stuff happened. Keating was out there. This guy was a buddy of Keating. And this guy's attitude was, somebody said, well, didn't a lot of people end up with like a lot of stuff, you know, real cheap of other people's stuff? He actually got the question when he was on CNBC one day. And you know what, Kyle? It's so different than you and me. He's one of these guys. He goes, our job was to get rid of this stuff. We had to grease the wheels a little bit. And you know what? If somebody got something a little cheaper than they got it, so what? Who cares? Or something. Our job was to get it done, and we did. And if some people did really, really pretty well on it, you know, that's the way it goes. The attitude, and he was a good guy. He was the guy, you know, he put in public service. He wasn't, you know, some idiot. I mean, or somebody who didn't care. But his point was, you know, sort of like Obamacare. Somewhere along the line, somebody said, all right, you can't kick every lobbyist out, or this thing won't be. It'll be 3 terms before this thing becomes a law. Just give people what they want. Let's get it done. We'll try. Somewhere these guys pile into this for personal stuff, or for you know, just convenience or whatever. And at the end of the day, you go back and say, wait a minute, how did you take all this stuff from people in the Resolution Trust worth $1 billion and sell it to other connected people for, you know, 10% of that?
Yeah, ten cents of the buck, right?
Well, not only did you. How did they deserve that? Why didn't other people?
Well, they got it, but the problem is somebody else got screwed.
Well, yeah. And now those people become the captains of industry for the next decade or two or three.
This is the problem all across the board. And as I pointed out, and as I've pointed out many times, we are currently running a 30% fiscal deficit. We're blowing $2 trillion a year more than we're taking in taxes. Okay, that's
all right. We have to dash on. Why don't we do this? Ricardo's good at this. Ricardo, plunk that down on Tuesday. Let's talk deficits and so forth, because obviously all their estimates on Trump's tax deduction and all this other stuff.
I'll give you three things you can do. We can do it in the half hour.
Yep.
I'll give you three things we could do. Some of the pieces would require legislative approval, but not all of them. Some of them could be done by the executive without whether the Congress likes it or not, because the law is already there. And we could solve this problem.
Are we too far gone with the?
No, we could solve this problem, and there would be a huge dislocation in the economy, but it would be temporary. It would also, and you wouldn't like it, your clients wouldn't like it, because it would collapse asset prices in a big way.
Oh, sure would. Sure.
But it would also solve the problem. And it is absolute. People say it's impossible to fix it. No, it's not. We could fix it. We could fix it in literally an hour.
Well, if you think asset prices are, if something's trading at 300 times earnings, goes down to 150, I guess, you know,
if it goes down to 20, which is probably where it would end up.
Okay, but I mean, it's going to happen someday. It has to.
Yep. And the question is, would you like it to be something that actually ends up benefiting the common person or not?
I would make absolutely sure that the clients who were on board, I had puts for every one of those shares, and we wouldn't get hurt that bad. That would be...
You'd still get sliced, but you wouldn't be dead. Right.
Yeah, so but it... SP Futures up 4. Nancy, Carl, you have a nice weekend.
You too.
Are you going to go down and represent Scotty Scheffler in his case?
God, no. I hear he's bonded out. He's all good.
He's probably already out. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.